Welcome to the Mindspace Podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. The Mindspace Podcast is my personal, in-depth exploration of the science and practice of well-being. I'm sharing this journey with you because I believe we can all lead happier, more meaningful lives by getting the facts and training our minds. Join me as I learn and share the most inspiring insights about human flourishing from leading experts. Because we could all use a little more mind space. My guest today is Pete Kirchmer. Pete is a mindfulness coach in San Diego and the program director for the UCSD Center for Mindfulness MPEAK program. MPEAK here stands for Mindful Performance Enhancement, Awareness, and Knowledge. So in this context, Pete works with athletes, executives, leaders, musicians, dancers, law enforcement, military personnel, first responders, and anyone who sets big goals and pushes themselves towards excellence. He's also in the process of developing the MPEAK coach training program, which equips mindfulness teachers to work with that population. So as his bio indicates, Pete is working at the rich intersection of mindfulness and peak performance. I've been curious about this area for a long time myself, partly because I recognize the well-being and performance-enhancing effects of mindfulness training, but also because it's not obvious how to integrate this kind of mind training into a performance context. After all, mindfulness is associated with acceptance of present moment experience and detachment from outcome, whereas performance is all about outcome. I actually attended an MPEAK retreat with Pete a few years ago and found it incredibly helpful for working all of this out, both for myself and the high-performing clients I work with. So I'm very fortunate to have Pete on the podcast today to take us on a deep dive and get some clarity on all these issues. Our conversation covered how to make sense of the apparent paradox between mindfulness and performance, the link between mindfulness and flow, some concrete examples of how to bring mindfulness into performance settings, how Pete uses his own mindfulness practice to sustain his energy and passion, and how Pete navigates working with clients who you would expect to be highly skeptical about mindfulness training. Now, if you're interested in this approach, Mindspace has an experienced team of mindfulness coaches, including myself, who can guide you through mindfulness training and its integration into peak performance. Please reach out to us at mindspacewellbeing.com or info@mindspacewellbeing.com. And now I bring you my conversation with Pete Kirchmer. Hey, Pete Kirchmer, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure and actually an honor to have you. I haven't seen you much in recent years, but we had lunch together the other day, and I had a great opportunity to train with you a few years ago in San Diego. So I'm really excited to catch up with you again and just kick off this conversation.
Yeah.
Pete, can you start us off by talking about what exactly you do and how you got into this line of work?
Sure. So I call myself a mindfulness coach. And so that looks like a couple different things. One is delivering courses like mindfulness-based stress reduction and the MPEAK mindful performance course for UCSD. I also do a professional training for being an MPEAK coach. And I have a private practice. So I work with individuals one-on-one. These are typically people looking for stress reduction, healthy lifestyle change, performance enhancement, across many different domains, work, life, sport. So that's my day job.
Cool. I'd like to kind of address probably the question that many people have, and certainly I had when I got into training with you, which is this weird kind of paradox that on the surface arises when we talk about mindfulness and performance. How do those two things mix? Isn't mindfulness about letting go? Isn't mindfulness about accepting and appreciating how things already are, being a little bit less goal-oriented? How do you make sense of, you know, how that mixes with performance, which is really about outcome, which is really about attachment?
Yeah. And so in some senses, it very much is a paradox. I love that you use that word. And in other ways, you know, the mindful approach to performance is a redefinition. So from the, maybe old school view of performance as being just outcome based, we're really looking at performance as a way of being, you know, really being present to the opportunities that present themselves from moment to moment. And this is actually consistent with performance enhancement. The more that we get caught up, you know, in the mental parts of performance and evaluation and such, really the harder it is to perform well. And so mindfulness lends itself quite well to performance in a lot of the skills that it delivers.
So mindful performance is about performance as a way of being, but again, the people you're coaching are going to be really concerned about outcome. And they care how things work out. So, you know, they could show up and be in a particular way, but ultimately it's about achieving a certain result, no?
So here is that outcome. And I don't want to take that away from people. Absolutely. I work with Olympic athletes. They want the gold. You know, I work with entrepreneurs or executives. They need to make a certain quota, you know, at the end of a quarter. And so, again, the paradox is how do you hold that as being true as an aspiration, but how do you hold it lightly with non-attachment, recognizing that you wanting that doesn't actually help you get it. In fact, you wanting that may even be a distraction, right? So if you are constantly thinking about this end game of winning your gold medal, that could pull you out of the present moment, which is the only place you really have an opportunity to perform. And so, you know, there's a way to negotiate both. Right, just holding a goal lightly, and yet recognizing that we can't focus on the future; we can only focus on what's here now.
That is super interesting, and it reminds me of a preoccupation that arises in therapy as well. And just give me a sec as I kind of flesh this out for you. When I'm doing clinical work using mindfulness, my clients are very preoccupied about the outcome. They want to feel better. They want to get past whatever mental health issue they have. And so the outcome is extremely important. But as you say, showing up in a mindful way to that healing process means holding the outcome lightly and also being in the present moment with how things currently are. So here's a question that often comes out of that. Are you coaching people and encouraging people to be mindful, to show up mindfully to their performance, ultimately as a tool or using mindfulness instrumentally to ultimately improve performance? Or are you asking people to be fully present, fully sort of non-attached to outcome as they show up in this mindful way, and then just let the outcome take care of itself?
Yeah, we call the performance enhancement part of the title the Trojan horse. It's what gets a lot of people in the door, but ultimately it's not what's most important. Right? We talk about well-being, quality of life, the finding joy in the act or process of performing. And so, yeah, of course, everyone would prefer to have the outcome work out, but it's not the focus. We kind of just trust that the results will take care of themselves if you can show up and be your full expression of who you are, you know, in every moment.
So mindfulness is the end in itself in this context.
Yes. Yeah, the way that also, even in life coaching, there's a distinction between performance coaching and developmental coaching. But the two really inform each other. And so there's developmental coaching, which is expanding ability to take, you know, broader perspectives, understanding, you know, oneself from a more, evolved perspective as well. Deepening presence. And then there's like performance coaching, which traditionally done in corporations is very outcome based. And the two, I would say, really, they go hand in hand. It's like the right and left wing. When you increase development, it's said that performance will increase. And yet also having, you know, a performance based aspiration can give motivation to whatever you're doing. And so that can actually help drive development as well.
Yeah, that strikes me as super important in the sense that part of what creates this apparent paradox is thinking of mindfulness and performance as opposites or as two ends of a continuum, whereas they're actually important complementary factors, right?
Yes, absolutely.
One area I've come across some of this work is this whole notion of the mindful athlete. So George Mumford's famous book, he spends a lot of time talking about how mindfulness helps set the conditions for flow. Are you working with flow as well? How do you see flow fitting into the mix? And maybe for people that aren't familiar with flow, maybe you can just talk about what it is and how it might be similar or different to mindfulness.
Yeah, so flow is one of the modules that's explored in MPEAK. And for those who are not familiar with it, it is the state of ultra-high performance, often referred to as the zone. It usually is characterized by a sense of time distortion, either slowing down or speeding up, a loss of self, which basically means an absence of thoughts, usually is quite pleasant. It's an absorption state. So usually the outcome, although it's not an outcome focus, the outcome is one's best performance. And how mindfulness can help prime us for flow, and I guess I can say a little bit about priming, is that there's not an on switch to flow. I like the quote that enlightenment is an accident and meditation makes you accident prone. And I think it's very similar for flow. Right, flow just kind of happens with enough grace and the right conditions, and meditation and mindfulness help make us more accident prone to flow. And so I had already mentioned this correlation to the selflessness or thoughtlessness. And so, of course, there's the work that many of your listeners will be familiar with around mindfulness decreasing default mode network activity and being able to let go or allow thoughts so that thoughts don't control your experience. And so this is one doorway into the state of flow. There's also the part that is this kind of immersion with the activity, which requires a deep focus. And what we also know is that mindfulness trains the ability to have deep focus. One of the flow conditions is also what I will refer to as balanced effort, where Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the researcher who's done most of the work on flow, he says it's this place that occurs when your skill is directly proportionate to your challenge, or maybe your challenge is just a little bit greater than your skill and ability. And these conditions pull you into flow. And so being able for someone or having the ability to tune in and to really pause and assess one's energy and resources in any moment, and then give the appropriate amount, or maybe just a little bit more, having that wisdom of like, can I actually go for two more hours? Can I push a little bit harder, or is that going to be too much? And so really that balanced effort is another flow condition.
So the awareness that we get from being mindful in a performance context helps us slide into flow more reliably?
Yes. And that's what the research now shows, although it's mostly subjective, outcome kind of measures. But yeah, the research on athletes shows that mindfulness has given them greater access to flow states.
That is really a really cool finding. And I do want to talk science in one sec, but one more kind of counterintuitive thing that I noticed with the work that you do. So as I mentioned, I went out to San Diego and did the week-long training with you. And I was really surprised, pleasantly so, to see that there was a module on self-compassion. And my initial reaction was like, wow, self-compassion in a mindful performance training. Do like Red Bull athletes and Olympic athletes need self-compassion? Aren't these people so confident? Like, how does that fit in?
Yeah, right. That's the perception we have of these high performers. We hold them on some kind of a pedestal as if they don't have any fear, and they're just immune to any negativity. But these are humans. Even the most elite, they have perfectionistic tendencies. They hold really high standards for themselves, and then when they don't meet those standards, and they fail or make mistakes, they tend to beat themselves up quite a bit. So self-compassion is the antidote for inner criticism that comes with any kind of failure or, you know, or distress. It's part of competition. You know, winning sometimes happens, losing sometimes happens. And so self-compassion is this way of, you know, meeting oneself with this nurturing energy, which can be soothing when there's a loss. And we call that yin self-compassion. But yang self-compassion is also important. Being able to, you know, take disciplined actions that are consistent with values, or being able to set boundaries that protect time, energy, and space. So both yin and yang compassion are definitely an important part of the MP curriculum.
I have to say, I've used that sort of approach or that little module quite a bit when I'm working with sort of higher performing clients. And what really stuck with me is this notion that actually high performing athletes, because they've always been pushing limits and trying to get better and competing against people better than them in their development, they've actually had to become experts in failure. And they have to develop the psychological tools to just extract all the possible value from failure and then keep going. And I remember very well, you guys showed us that amazing Nike ad with Michael Jordan, where he lists all of his failures. And I think the punchline is, I've failed and that is why I succeed, or something like that.
Yeah.
Have I sort of captured the essence of that wisdom right there?
Yeah. And I love that you also added extracting value from failure. So like with this growth mindset, one can really evaluate what the lessons were and use failure as one of the greatest growing opportunities, right? When you have a success, you can use mindfulness to savor it and really enjoy it. And maybe you can reflect on what you did well, you know, that caused the success. But I would say that failure has such an intensity to it that the lessons are often far more transformative. And so just even having the intention to use failure as a learning experience can be really valuable.
That's amazing. So what does the science say about mindful performance?
So, you know, we did a study with the U.S. Olympic BMX team, and it was actually what launched MPEAK. The BMX team did really well. They got 3 medals in the 2008 Olympics. It was the first year that BMX was in the Olympics. And then in the 2012 Olympics, they didn't get any medals. And the coach was pretty sure that it was all in the athlete's head. And so he had just recently written a book called Cracking the Athlete's Brain by Martin Paulus, who had a lab at the time, a neuroscience lab at UCSD. And so a team at UCSD Center for Mindfulness, this is right before I came on board, got together with the BMX coach and the team and the neuroscientists at the lab, and they created this study, naming it then MPEAK, but it was a 7-week intervention where they used mindfulness meditation, and it was very similar to MBSR originally. And what they found was that there are neural correlates to resilience. And so when they put the athletes under what's called an interoceptive load, breath restriction, so a universally panic-inducing stressful state, the high performers or these athletes were able to respond with resilience. And so what had already been found before the study was that high performers' brains look different than normal people's brains when under this kind of stress load. So the way that the anterior cingulate cortex fired with the insula was the signature of stress resilience. And then what was found was that mindfulness meditation made normal people's brains look more like that of the elite performers. And then what the BMX study showed is that there's no ceiling effect, and that mindfulness can take someone who already has an elite-looking brain and actually make it look more elite when under stress. And so why this was significant is it's really one of the only studies right now to show the neural correlates of resilience and performance. In this demographic, it was repeated on adventure racers and military elite. So previously and still currently, most of the research is subjective outcome measures. And, I think it's all a very great start, showing improved optimism, decreased in performance anxiety, increases in perception of flow, decreased in stress, more responsiveness versus reactivity, right? So this is what's at least being found in athletics. So there's a lot of room for improvement, but there's also a lot of room for hope.
So is it fair to say that imaging work suggests that when under stress, these athletes with a mindfulness practice are less likely to be distracted or derailed by these stressful conditions, which would imply that their performance won't be affected by stressful conditions?
Yes, that's it. Yep, that's resilience, is being able to feel into the discomfort, but to still, keep one's presence and one's grounding and to still perform at an elite level despite, the fear or physical distress.
And presumably, this is a very valuable capacity to have, because I'm guessing that at these elite levels, a lot of the athletes have similar skill levels, but it's really their mindset that might create the difference between winning and losing. Is that a fair statement?
It is. And actually, it's a statement that most coaches, sports psychologists, and athletes will make. And they'll even go as far as to say that, at an elite level, it's 80% mental, 20% physical. And yet, this commitment to mental training is actually still quite new and unique.
Well, very interesting. So I want to actually get into some examples of, the kinds of work that you do. But I want to try something out before we do that. I found it super interesting. Right before I hit record here on my audio setup, we were just talking about, how this was going to go and the sense of like, there is a performative quality to this podcast. And you just sort of acknowledged that and made a statement about that reflected your mindset going into this particular performance that you and I are about to get into. Can you just repeat for listeners what you said and what you were doing when you made that statement?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, like the acknowledgement was like that the podcast actually has all of the flow conditions, risk, novelty, and complexity. I was feeling just, a sense of intensity before coming on, knowing that this complexity and a lot of unknowns were ahead of me. And so kind of the way that I set my mind and what I said to you is that I practice just letting go with the intention that this, whatever occurs in our conversation, be of benefit to other people in whatever way that looks. And that for me to let go and just kind of trust the process, and whatever spontaneously emerges.
So what I find especially interesting about that is the second part is what you would expect of a mindful attitude or a mindful perspective on an experience. But the first part was a pleasant surprise in the sense that you named the sort of deeper purpose that you were engaged with here, which we don't typically associate with mindfulness practice. Am I picking up on the right elements here, and why state purpose?
Yeah, I think an aspiration, an intention, or a sense of purpose is important to bring to mindfulness practice. It's actually one of the first things we clarify in the first morning of the MPEAK course, like what brought you here on the deepest level, to what end? If it's not just to win, what else do you get out of this? So it really is an inquiry we have people try on. And I think it's even maybe more relevant to the high-performing population a lot of the people that showed up to my MBSR classes were pre-sold. They're suffering, right? They're in anxiety or depression or chronic pain or some kind of a symptom that has not been easily alleviated by Western medicine. So maybe desperation is too big of a word for, you know, to generalize, but there is a degree of, you know, urgency. And so that urgency to get out of suffering is the energy or motivation to practice. And it requires a lot of energy and motivation if you're going to set the intention to sit and do nothing, which can be very radical for our culture. And if you're going to do that every day for 8 weeks, with a high-performing population, they are suffering to some degree, right? They're coming in feeling like they need to always be on. They have really, again, high expectations of themselves. They have a hard time with work-life balance. They usually are, you know, driven sometimes to burnout or injury, right? So there is that, but they don't identify with their stress and suffering. It's not the forefront of their experience. So being able to anchor them into some deeper purpose of why they're here is helpful when, after the honeymoon phase, you know, of meditation wears off at week two, that they can then recollect this aspiration to fuel, you know, their meditation practice, or at least to overcome the voice that says, maybe you just have coffee instead this morning. Maybe you just kind of hang out and check your emails rather than meditate, right? But in that moment, recognizing that voice and then remembering, you know, the aspiration, whatever that might be, I would say adds a richness and an importance to the practice.
So I want to keep going with this because I just find it personally interesting. Setting the intention to be mindful, to be present, to let go, and just trust the process that we're about to engage in with the podcast, that plays the function of regulating, to some extent, the little bit of stress or discomfort that we feel stepping into the unknown as we start recording. And so it's a kind of an affect regulation tool, and that's how I use it in my own life, and I teach my clients to use it. But I feel like stating the deeper purpose of why we're doing this adds something more. I think it also helps kind of regulate affect, but it also creates a sense of alignment, which I find really interesting, this experience of alignment that I'm doing something that is important to me. It is connecting to my values, and it connects to sort of this bigger picture element of experience. And there's something very important about that, in my opinion, that is not always captured by traditional mindfulness programs. Do you agree? How does that land with you?
Yeah. You know, I would say that although it's maybe not at the forefront of traditional mindfulness programs, it's definitely in the DNA, right? The Bodhisattva vow comes to mind. May the benefits and merits of this practice be of benefit to all being, or may this contribute to the end of suffering and the realization of true happiness. And so, like, this is something that's repeated in the Tibetan tradition daily. You know? So it's there, this sense of aspiration beyond one's, you know, egoic self, to have this sense of purpose. But it doesn't seem to be forefront, say, in MBSR. In MBSR, at least at UCSD, we start out with what's called the well visualization, visualizing this rock sinking deeper and deeper into the well, and the well ends up being the well of your own being. And as the rock sinks deeper, it reveals different layers of intention for being in the program. And the deepest layer, when people share, it usually is this kind of, I want to be my best self for the people in my life I love. And so it does come out, but then the next thing that we say in the training is, okay, thank you for sharing that. Now let's put that on the shelf. And let's not continue to look at this. And I think that, again, that's the teaching around holding it lightly and not always looking for this as an outcome. But if we can look at it rather than being an outcome that we're seeking, but just being this kind of intentional or aspirational or purposeful motivator, I think that brings a lot of value and richness to anyone who's teaching or taking a mindfulness course.
Yeah.
I agree that it is kind of embedded and implicit in a lot of mindfulness programs, as you say, because of, let's say, more ancient roots of this practice. And I'm just sort of toying around with the idea of, what do you add or lose by making that alignment issue or the sense of purpose more explicit? It might add tools for affect regulation. It might add motivation. It might add consistency to the practice, things like that. But it may be the case that it's reinforcing an identification with outcome that is the very thing that's causing suffering in the MBSR participants in the first place.
And that might be the fear, that when interpreted in that way, it could lead to that. In my own experience, kind of stating what I stated to you in the very beginning, gave me access to two of Jon Kabat-Zinn's foundational attitudes of letting go and trust. Right? So to really let go of my expectations of how this could go, or all my preferences, and really just trust the conversation that's going to happen between us.
But that is the traditional mindfulness move, but you added another layer, which is what I found really interesting.
Yes. Yeah. And I think, again, that just gives access to that.
What do you mean? It gives access to what?
The trust, the letting go.
I see.
By stating the purpose.
Oh, so it facilitates a mindful mindset.
It does for me.
Okay. Interesting. Can you explain that a bit more?
So if I came in with an expectation that I wanted this to go a certain way, or I had scripted it and wanted to make sure I said certain things, right? I come in with a certain attachment, a certain preference. I end up getting in my own way. It probably decreases my presence and my spontaneity. But in the moment of stating, may this be of benefit to others, it reminds me that this is not all about me. Right? And this is not about my preferences, and that I can just relax and trust emergence, get out of my own way. Right. And so it has this kind of, it feels like the aspirational qualities are what solidify this feeling of, maybe solidify is not the right word, but give access to this, this mindful state.
Yeah. And that speaks to this issue of the aspirational piece and the mindfulness piece being complementary and mutually reinforcing and not paradoxical.
Yes. And that's why it's a practice, because of course there are so many different hangups and pitfalls and little ditches that people can get into, on the path towards mindfulness. And here's again where the need for the teacher, the sangha, and a commitment to practice over years will serve us.
Very interesting stuff. Thanks for going on that detour with me. I'd love to hear about some of the actual work that you're doing. So obviously we're going to protect the privacy of your clients, but I know you've done some work, for example, with Olympic athletes. That's what brought you to Montreal in the fall. And I know you've done some work with the Department of Homeland Security. Can you just tell us, some of the actual work that you've done of late, and maybe how you experience it from the inside as the coach or the trainer in these cases?
Sure, a lot of directions we could go. So just I'll touch on the Olympics. I was invited to work with the Canadian Olympic Committee in a kickoff event for the Tokyo Olympics that'll be coming up in 2020, I was able to address the coaches and sports psychologists, as well as the athletes in different breakout sessions. So it's just really an honor to be there and to work with that, that culture. I have so much respect for the Canadian Olympic Committee, who actually their entire event was based on finding purpose. They called it Ikigai, which is Japanese for finding this intersection of purpose and performance and intention. And so what a beautiful event to get to do that. And I've worked with some coaches and athletes from the Swedish Olympic team, and we'll be going to New Zealand to work with their sports psychologists for the Olympics in May. But the work that I'm actually most regularly engaged with is the Department of Homeland Security. So we have a 2-year contract through the UCSD Center for Mindfulness with what I'll now refer to as DHS. Everything with them is an acronym, but work with Border Patrol, Immigrations and Customs, Secret Service, Coast Guard. And it's a pretty new contract. So I'm really just getting my feet wet with this culture. And it started with going down to the borders and, and through the different agencies, Coast Guard, obviously going to the coast where they were headquartered and doing these briefings, just introducing, mindfulness and performance and MPEAK to leadership. Just letting them know that there were funds available and seeing if we could drum up some interest. And I kind of went in braced for resistance and ready for skepticism, and had situations where I would go into a room of 40 Border Patrol agents, for instance, all in their green uniforms and, carrying holsters with guns. And so it was a very unique experience.
Well, if it's anything like my experience when I drive to the border, I get scared of like the 21-year-old pimply guy who just wants to see my passport. I can't imagine what it's like to walk into that room.
I think it's like an embedded reaction. You see sirens, and even if I'm not speeding, I slow down, right? So we just react to the authority. At least I've noticed I do. So it was a good opportunity to just get over all of that, and to really anchor into the common humanity that these people are working a difficult job, and they too have a lot of stress and demands for them to be on and performing at their best. And so, again, an opportunity to really just let go of myself and to show up from a place of service, and was repeatedly surprised at how open and receptive the group has been. And all the times that I've presented it, again, each time ready for anything, knowing, this could go south, and it just never does. If anything, the questions are around how much funding do we actually have and can we get everyone through this? So it's been really a pleasant surprise so far to work with these people.
It is, as we said at the outset, a little counterintuitive to think that an Olympic athlete would need training in self-compassion and dealing with failure and learning how to be present in the moment and these sorts of things. It is even a bigger stretch to imagine a room full of guys with guns needing or being open to that kind of input. How are they, is it different or similar? How are they interfacing with the material?
So once they get into the program, and I will also say that we've made it be all voluntary, so no one is voluntold. They don't have to come to the MPEAK program. And so they do sign up themselves, and they come plain clothes. So when I would deliver my 90-minute briefing to them, they were just in the middle of a work day. But when they come to the MPEAK, it's delivered in a 3-day intensive format to begin with, and then there's some virtual follow-up. But they come plain clothes, and I would say that it would be hard to tell the difference between them and an athlete or a physician or a teacher or an executive or anyone else that shows up at an MPEAK class. Beyond all of the roles, of the different people I serve, these role of high performers is a human being with hopes and desires and fears and expectations. And, they all also have this desire to be happy, to live a good life, to be a good person for their family. And that's what feels like it's most obvious in the classroom. Again, this common humanity. I don't see their Border Patrolness show up all that much once we really get into it.
I have to say that in my own experience teaching mindfulness in a variety of contexts, there's something unbelievably empowering and exciting about seeing that, like, oh my God, it applies here too. when a client comes to see me because they're suffering or struggling with something, yeah, it makes sense that what I'm teaching is going to fit. But then if I'm working with, I recently did some training with a group of long distance runners, and I just left there thinking like, wow, that's so incredible. It's the same tools. It's the same needs, totally different context. And I just remember being like so profoundly inspired about, I guess, the common humanity piece or whatever it may be. Is this how you feel?
Yeah, I kind of, I've, especially in the early days, would show up thinking, well, this worked for me, but maybe I'm weird. Yeah. I don't know if everyone else is going to like it. I hope they do, because I think it's cool. But So it's like, you know, I think it was good for my humility. But like especially in the beginning, just showing up thinking, I don't know if they're going to like this. And so maybe there'll be one day where I'm not surprised anymore that, you know, it works for everyone. But yeah, still today, I show up and I'm like a mix of both grateful and relieved, after after the first hour is over and I realize it's all going to be okay.
It strikes me here that this is a lot. Like your job requires a lot from you. So, you know, there's the travel, which is kind of depleting in its own way, but it is quite challenging to really show up fully present and in your practice, working with so many, in so many different contexts, with so many different types of clients. How do you manage your energies and how do you manage your capacity to really be present with the, with people, given that there's some adapting to do to these different cultural contexts?
Yeah, you know, at this point, although I, you know, still try to engage with high performance activities, some of which are sports, some of which are not, so I definitely have my own practices that support that. But really, I'd say my greatest high performance activity right now is just that. It's showing up and teaching these 3-day intensives because it does require the most of me. I think I come with a little bit higher capacity for this. I think I'm just wired this way. I can teach solo. A lot of other teachers, you know, really feel like they need a co-teacher. And where I do see the value in that in a lot of ways, I actually prefer to teach solo. It keeps me in a certain flow. It keeps me in my rhythm. And, you know, I practice a lot of what I preach, especially this balanced effort, you know, approach. I set a nice sustainable pace with the group. I know where my break point, you know, my breaking times are. And when I say breaking times, I don't mean like breaking down. I mean like, at this point, I'm going to send them into a dyad for 7 minutes. And then during that dyad, I'm going to find my breath, check back in, really re-anchor into my body. And then after the dyad's over, I'm kind of back at it again. And so, you know, I set up the teaching rhythm to have these little rest and reflect moments throughout the day. And I think that's sustaining. I would say just also like the intensity of the work and like my true desire to be fully present to the group, it just keeps me sharp. Mm-hmm. Throughout the day. And I, you know, I have a certain way that I prepare. I don't want to do anything strenuous the day before I teach. During the 3 days that I'm teaching, I don't make plans in the evenings for afterwards, to the best that I can. You know, I try to really just come home and, I'm grateful to live on the ocean. So I'll typically spend some time in nature, go down to the beach. And so there's some, you know, some self-care that I'll do in the evenings. And so I've kind of sorted it out where it's really, it is actually, it's intense, but it's quite manageable, I found.
So I'm going to, open up my crazy internal monologue for a second here and kind of share some of my like snap judgments about you and your capacity to perform. So people don't see you here, but you're a big dude. You're, what are you, like 6'3", 6'2"?
No, I'm 6 foot tall.
Oh, you're 6 feet tall. That's so funny. I imagined you taller, or I remember you being taller. So you're reasonably tall, but you're a big guy. You used to be a football player. You're well built. And my kind of neurotic thinking about this is like, oh, well, you know, Pete you know, he's a big guy, he's an athlete, he's got tons of energy. You know, I'm the sort of like skinny neurotic Jewish guy, and like I get tired after like one meeting, or when I just dropping my kids off at the daycare in the morning is a huge schlep for me. Maybe you're just built with energy and you have this extra capacity.
That's funny. yeah, no, I mean, I do think I would say objectively, like no real ego involved. I do think I have a certain capacity. You know, there are certain people that are just built for long distance marathons. I am not built with that kind of capacity, but I can sustain presence and I can be present to other people. But I think that was trained through my one-on-one coaching practice. Having one client after the next and really just wanting to give them my full attention year after year helped cultivate this. And by the way, I see you very much the same way. I'm like, oh, Joe has multiple mindfulness clinics where he's managing, offices, and he's a client load. He's teaching courses. He's got a podcast. He's sending out newsletters. He has a family. I don't have kids that I'm trying to manage on top of all this. So it's funny how we project excellence onto right. one another.
It's funny, yeah, and the perception, the difference between the perception of others versus the perception of ourselves.
Yeah.
It strikes me just as we're talking with this that you haven't told the story about how you got into mindfulness in the first place, which maybe belongs at the beginning here, but you were a high-level football player, and I think you were in the weight room a lot, and you had back issues. And I'd love you to tell the story about how that pain sort of forced you into a shift in your perspective on performance.
Sure. Yeah. I wouldn't say I was a high level performing football player. I was a pretty average football player, but I tried really hard.
Yeah. Maybe, which there's the perception piece again.
So I threw the shot put in the disc for track and field, and I was a competitive power lifter. So, you know, was into kind of the big, you know, bigger, faster, stronger type of athletics through high school. And maybe some genetic predisposition for back injury, maybe just, I call it my self-inflicted overuse injury. You know, I don't know, but whatever the case may be, I ruptured a disc when I was 16 years old. And that really set me on the path that I'm on today. I started asking big questions. It was kind of an ego identity loss at the time. All of my friends were associated with sports, and if I couldn't do that, who am I? So because I was young, I healed pretty quickly, although the original injury did give me this idea that maybe being a physical therapist would be an interesting, you know, career to pursue. So I did. I actually was working as a physical therapy aide towards the end of high school, and then through college while I was studying to become a physical therapist. And at some point, I guess at age 21, right before I was graduating, I had a second surgery injury and then surgery, but this time actually had permanent nerve damage in my left leg as a result of the sciatic nerve being cut. Whether that was done during the surgery or the disc that just, you know, hardened on the nerve, I don't know, but I had paralysis of my gastrocnemius and a lot of weakness in my left leg. And so this really had me take a step back. I had to evaluate not only what I was doing, but who I was being. You know, I had some recognition that my mind was just set up to injure myself. I was going to strive and drive and actually just wouldn't leave the gym until I hurt. That was my signal to go home. You know, oh, something's about to pop. I better, you know, better call it a day. And so started taking, you know, personal development workshops. I started working with a life coach, and, you know, started this kind of inner healing transformation. And at the time, I was also working with patients at the physical therapy center. And so then would try on some of the self-development tools or practices that I was learning on some of the patients and the ones who were open to it. It felt like it had an impact on how they dealt with the healing, or if they had a victim mentality of they were hit by a car and they were angry, versus if they saw it as, you know, a learning opportunity or an opportunity for self-reflection, it seemed like they suffered less when they would really see it as this opportunity. And so that was fascinating to me. And it actually inspired a shift in my, you know, in my career choice. So I abandoned the idea of continuing on to get my doctorate or master's in physical therapy. And I actually started taking a life coaching certification. I got involved in taking yoga classes. Was actually my first entry into mindfulness. And at the time, this was, I guess, 1999. I was the only male in class and about 40 years younger than everyone else. So it was definitely before yoga was cool. For me, it was very not cool. But there was something there, right? I clearly was making connections and there was some value that I perceived enough for me to take that on as a personal path and as a professional path. So then pursued the certification in life coaching. I started to meditate around the same time, and it was just really good timing in that I started my meditation practice and then got a job at a place called Rancho La Puerta, which is a wellness retreat or resort in Tecate, Mexico. And at the time, they had no real Wi-Fi signal. You could only get telephone reception on the top of a mountain. The only television station that came in was Mexican soap operas, right? So there was like no distractions. I could spend a lot of time reading and meditating and being in nature. And so it was almost like this modern day monkhood for a couple years that I was able to really deepen into. And then when I decided it was time to transition from there, you know, I just came back to California, sought out a sangha and teacher, and started with retreat practice. And, you know, I guess it just, I'd like to say happily ever after, but I could say maybe just practicing ever after.
I like that. So we talked earlier about your self-care practices around performance. I wonder if we can just broaden out and talk a little bit about how you like about your mindfulness practice in general and what stuff you're doing to stay well and to stay sort of engaged with all the projects in your life.
Yeah. So I reflect back to the traditions, and often one of the criticisms of modern mindfulness is that it is just one practice extracted from a lot of practices, including, you know, ethical frameworks and things like that. So when you look at mindfulness in its traditional presentation, often there's, you know, the creation of mandala, there's chanting, there's service, there's fasting. I look at these in kind of, I guess, from maybe my fitness background. I call it mindfulness cross training. So I look for complementary practices that I can actually step into as a mindfulness practice. So they don't inherently need to be a mindfulness practice, but I bring that as an intention. So I took an improv comedy course last year for about a half a year. And, you know, when coming in with an attitude of mindfulness, it's this way to cultivate spontaneity. Often mindfulness is, you know, seen in its more deliberate fashion where, you know, you're entering a difficult conversation and really just need to pause and reflect, and you might observe three different thoughts come up, and then with discernment, you choose the appropriate response, but it's very deliberate, it's intentional. But there's another face of mindfulness that's more conducive to the skill set of flow, which is, again, trusting emergence, getting out of your own way, and just allowing, you know, whatever wants to come through you to come through you unfiltered. And when the environment's right, this is a beautiful practice. And so improv comedy was this way of setting up these conditions where there are different exercises where you're just trying to think quickly and react quickly, to train the mind to, you know, just for maybe even word association. There's more creative exercises that would bring in kind of play or a certain sense of silliness, which, you know, at the time was not my norm. And so that required a certain kind of letting go in order to be seen as silly. Like, I'm a professional. I'm a serious guy. Like, nope, not right now. We're cultivating a different edge. And then relational flow, where you do these little skits with other people, you know, just creating in the moment some kind of a scenario. It's like, hey, you're a sushi chef, you're a car mechanic, you have Tourette's, and you know, you've got a limp, and now go, just do a skit, you know. Like, and so that was a really fun mindfulness cross training. But I also do other things like regular deprivation or flotation tank sessions, which I've gotten a lot of benefit from. I do holotropic breath work as a mindfulness cross training. I've done some archery recently. This is, you know, cultivating, you know, focus. I work in like cryotherapy or do cold plunges. I've got a friend with a 34 degree ice bath in his backyard. And so that's a way to like bring mindfulness to discomfort. I have a hot sauna in my house that I use. So meditating in the hot sauna, I would say it is also a nice cross training tool. And then I'm always, you know, working with different teachers. Right now I'm working with Vince Horn doing pragmatic Dharma, which is the social noting practice, or meditating out loud with other people, mentally noting, you know, different phenomenon that arises in awareness, and, you know, what we're actually noting changes from, you know, from day to day. And so it keeps it fresh, and it also balances out my practice. And of course I have just regular, you know, sit every morning for half an hour, sit with a sangha, have a teacher I meet with regularly. So, I guess as I hear myself saying it all, it's like, good thing I don't have a family, right?
Yeah. I'm noting jealousy arising.
Jealousy arising.
Pete, I'm curious to hear more about this holotropic breath work. Can you tell me about that and how it fits in with your other practices?
Yeah, so this is a practice that might be more in the lineage of kind of the yogic pranayama, in that it's this fast-paced breathing that's often done accompanied by an evocative music that creates an altered, somewhat psychedelic state where emotions that have been repressed come to the surface and can be, you know, processed and experienced, and that often then give way to, you know, states of bliss and even rapture and love. I would say that for your listeners who have heard of this kind of psychedelic renaissance, you know, books like by Michael Pollan and a lot of the research out of John Hopkins and UCLA and Imperial College of London that are coming around psychedelic use, even in combination with meditation for personal growth. Holotropic breathwork is a natural form. It's a way to access these psychedelic states without doing something illegal.
So what do you experience?
So it's a journey, and it can be anywhere between 1 and 3 hours in length. And in the beginning, there's a little bit of work. And so there's just this focus on the breath, and there is finding the rhythm of the breath, and then there's some absorption into the music. And at some point, there's a letting go. The breath kind of takes over. There's no longer, you know, the experience of trying to effort the breath. It just becomes automatic. And then often there's kind of different emotions that will arise. And then there's the observer. There's the awareness of these emotions. Maybe it's, you know, some people experience things like their birth experience, you know, very abstract, deeply repressed or intangible like experiences. Or sometimes it's just a reflection on something I said earlier that day that maybe I shouldn't have. And so I start to, you know, review whatever material comes up. There's this feeling of compassion around whatever comes up. And it's just another way to work with emotions. But I would say that it's more intense than the way we would work with emotions in a traditional, you know, sitting mindfulness practice.
That is super interesting. And thanks for taking us through that. Pete, I'm mindful of the time here. We're around the 1 hour mark. And one of the things I definitely want to get from you before we stop is if you could provide, it's like one little nugget, one little principle or piece of advice for listeners about how they might think about or incorporate mindfulness into performance.
Take my MPEAK class.
Not fair.
The one little nugget.
It could be anything. I mean, and you can make it two or three if that's easier for you, but just something that people can think about or something that people might consider if they want to get started or, you know, just one piece of advice you'd have for people that are curious about this.
To identify where in their area of performance there's opportunity for mindfulness. And so, let's say when I'm working with athletes, an athlete like a basketball player who has halftime and penalty breaks, maybe I should have used hockey players for your Canadian audience, but similar to basketball, right? There's timeouts, there's penalties. These would be obvious places to insert mindfulness into an athletic event. This would be different than, say, an ultramarathon runner or a triathlete who has more extended endurance periods. They might use mindfulness at different mile markers or at different time markers along their event. And so in MPEAK, we have people identify what are your mindfulness performance opportunities. I identified mine. You know, when I'm teaching a course, I know that during the first dyad, I have an opportunity for about 7 minutes to really pause and to reflect and to really take an extended period of mindfulness. And so for your listeners, for them to just recognize where in their areas of performance, or even more simple, where in their day can they insert intentional mindfulness activities? That might just be a pause and a reflect, but it might be to, you know, make a difficult conversation their mindfulness practice. Or it might make the beginning of whatever their performance event might be and the way that they prepare for it their mindfulness activity. So to really identify, you know, where can they insert mindfulness and then to experiment with doing so.
That really is excellent advice and a really nice opening into the work that you do. And who knows, you might have some people, some of our listeners joining you in California one of these days. So really, thank you so much for doing this. I wonder, before we break here, if you could just tell us how people can find you online and what kind of projects you're working on now that you'd like people to know about.
Yeah, so they can find me at mindfulness-based health/MPEAK if they're interested in that course. My coaching services are also available on that website. Some of the projects that I'm working on are around mindfulness and pain and potentially making an app for post-op decrease in opioid use. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the, that's a project I'm working on. And then, of course, I'm open for private coaching or open to answering any questions that your listeners might have about MPEAK.
That's awesome. You didn't mention the coaching certificate, or maybe you did, but I think it's worth just elaborating because it's a very interesting project.
Yeah. So people who are interested in becoming MPEAK coaches can participate in our 3-module training pathway. The first starts with a coach training intensive. This is a 3-day program working on coaching core skills of listening, reflecting, and asking deep questions, as well as the best practices for guiding meditation. And it also equips them with how to deliver like a 60 to 90 minute introduction to mindfulness and performance. Then going into the second module, which is the 10-week practicum, where they really take a deep dive into what it takes to teach the MPEAK curriculum in an 8-week format, followed up by mentorship, where I would support them through teaching their first class.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you might have me as one of your clients one of these days. I'd love to go through that. It sounds really awesome. And so why don't we leave it there? I think I've gobbled up enough of your time for today. So again, thank you so much, Pete. I really hope that my man crush did not sort of overwhelm listeners during this hour. And I really am an admirer of what you're doing and appreciate you taking the time today.
The man crush is mutual. It's been an honor.
Okay, man. So have a great weekend, and I hope to talk again soon.
Great. Cheers.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Mindspace podcast. The purpose of this project is to inspire people to cultivate well-being. The science tells us that well-being is best understood as a series of skills and habits that can be learned and practiced. And I hope listening to these episodes helps you move forward on your own path to well-being. If you find these episodes helpful in this respect, please do share them with friends, family, and colleagues, because we could all use a little more mind space.